Good morning and welcome. I am David Johnson. I am with Microsoft IT, and between myself and Carrie Doring, and we'll introduce ourselves in just a minute, we're here to talk today about how Microsoft governs Office 365 and specifically our SharePoint environments within Microsoft. I have been within Microsoft for about 18 years now. I have run SharePoint engineering in various projects since 2005. Most recently now, my role is all about helping Microsoft get to cloud and re-envision our solutions in a mobile-first, cloud-first way. Carrie.
Hi, I'm Carrie Doring, and let me advance this here so you can see my picture as well as my video. I've been at Microsoft about 9.5 years, and I've worked in a lot of different roles, one of them being governance and compliance. I think I joined the SharePoint practice about 3 years ago, and I've been really focused on how we govern our very, very large internal environment, both with regards to internal use and external use as well, which we'll have a chance to talk about today.
Absolutely. So we've been on quite a journey within Microsoft to kind of get us to what we would consider a reasonably good shape of SharePoint. We've got a huge footprint. We'll talk about that in a minute. But just from a logistic perspective, we're going to talk about how we govern our SharePoint environment. And we want to take your Q&A. We want to make sure we hear your questions. We're able to respond to them. It may not be real time, but please submit them into a tool, and then we can take your questions and deal with them. And at the end, we'll make sure we have some resources available around tools that you can use yourself and other things you can take a look at for after the session. So when we talk about our environment within Microsoft, so at Microsoft, we have a fairly large and rich environment of SharePoint. We use SharePoint for everything from team collaboration, portal workloads, business process automation. Basically, you think of how SharePoint it could be used, we probably use it that way within Microsoft. We've been on this journey to get to clouds for the last 4 years, roughly, and moved to Office 365. And this is just a quick view of what our landscape looks at. So when we think of it, when we think about governance, this is what effectively we're governing. We're governing an on-prem space where we have between the utility sites where we consider self-service, how people can go ahead and create a new team site on our on-premise environment. We also have our larger custom portal spaces, the bigger, more advanced farms with full trust customizations in some cases, or higher levels of need and business requirements and SLAs around it. But where we're really moving towards is that large right column, which is our 365 footprint, where we have the OneDrive for business sites and the vast majority now of our team sites. And now at this point, the vast majority of our portals are now there too. We've got portals remaining on-prem, but a huge chunk of our on-portals are on cloud. And I think we talked about that in our migration session, and we'll have some more information on that later. But for the purposes of this conversation, what we're really going to focus on is how we govern all these environments, and particularly that cloud environment. Underneath all this, by the way, we have shared services for our environments, everything from enterprise search, enterprise taxonomy, enterprise people, basically the core things that make the SharePoint information management really work well. We've got those both in the on-prem and in the cloud. So let's talk a little bit about what we're trying to do here. I mean, first things first, we're trying to make sure we can balance our what goes where from a SharePoint perspective of prem versus cloud. We want to be like any other company would be. Effectively, our desire, though, is to get as much of our footprint to cloud as possible. We believe it makes sense there for lots of reasons, for manageability reasons, for just everything being in one place, with all the advantages for being there from an employee perspective. There's a ton of value in being in the cloud. So we try to put as much there as possible. And so when we think about what goes where, we think about our basic OneDrive for business is completely in the cloud. We no longer have My Sites on-prem at this point within Microsoft. We're completely now 100% there. Our team sites, generally team sites and group collaboration, if you have a project or team collaboration purposes, those are generally being driven to cloud. There's exceptions to that, which we have on-prem. Generally, the teams that have regulated content that must sit in region. In those cases, we might keep that on-premise in a specific region. For example, maybe I have regulated content that must sit within Europe, and therefore we'll have an on-prem farm remaining that sits in Europe. But for the most part, our team sites and team collab and document management are all within of a cloud environment. The other big thing that goes to cloud is our portal space, because we believe as we re-envision our employee experiences more broadly, we want to make sure those portals are in the cloud so they're accessible on my phone or any device, and I can then do things like build applications and new experiences against those portals. We also have our partner space. We're kind of having both sides. We have partners on-prem as well as online, where on cloud, and Carrie will talk about this a little bit later, how we manage and govern guest sharing and external sharing on 365. On-premise, we have a directory where we still have partner sharing on-premise, where we still manage a partner directory where we will master a partner account and we will provision and manage those partners on an on-premise environment. But generally, we're slowly moving to the cloud. Most of our footprint is now there. In fact, 97% of our SharePoint environment is in the cloud. And that's now what we'll talk about, how we manage that and think about that. So there's a lot of different types of governance of SharePoint. When you think about it, it's not just a one-size-fits-all thing, too. There's everything from service governance. How do you manage and deal with change management for your services themselves? Everything from application governance. That how do you take applications and manage them through your portfolio? 365 has a cloud app catalog available for you as an enterprise that we consume and we manage to say, here's our app portfolio. We vet apps that go in that app catalog internally, and we make them available. That's not the focus of this conversation, but that's one of the governance themes we have. The other governance work stream we have is on the discovery governance. How do we make sure we have the right content showing up in enterprise search? How do we make sure we're crawling the right things, but whether it's on-prem? How are we getting the hybrid search? How are we dealing with best bets? That I want to make sure that the best content is promoted within search. How do I do managed properties within search so I enable the ability to have discovery and refinement within that environment? How do we manage corporate taxonomy and enterprise schemas so I do good information management in the discovery space? That's all another kind of pivot to the governance space, the things that we do. Beyond that, we then do this broader SharePoint governance as we think about it in terms of the site lifecycle management. The fact that we have sites in cloud and on-premise, how do we manage the classification of those? How do we manage the lifecycle of those? How do we protect ourselves, make ourselves comfortable with that information? How do we make sure we don't have overload SharePoint sprawl going on and we've got a good reasonable set of SharePoint within the environment? We also have, I guess, along that, security governance. That how do we understand potentially risks with SharePoint more broadly? And above and beyond the kind of lifecycle management governance on a SharePoint site, how do we make sure that what are we doing, for example, of DLP or other technologies to kind of vet and govern SharePoint there? Did you want to add anything to that? Or?
Well, I was just going to say that's a lot of different kinds of governance, and that's a lot of topics to cover. And today we're really going to focus on that site and content governance in SharePoint.
Absolutely. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about classification for a minute. Like your organization, we try to divide up our content set. And one of the things that we require every Microsoft employee to do is once a year do an annual training of how do you basically, the code of business, standards of business conduct training. Every year you go through it and you've got to do things like understand the security guidelines, understand what it means to be ethical and so on. Part of that is understanding that you have to classify your content, certainly your containers of content within Microsoft. If you're building an application, if you're building a SharePoint site, if you're building a document library, we want to make sure that we understand that classification of content so we can then work with it appropriately, so people can manage it appropriately, so people understand when they're seeing it, the value of the assets stored within that application or document library. We have everything from what we call HBI, which is what we effectively, it's our equivalency of top secret. It's things that at Microsoft are the secrets that we really want to prevent leakage for. Think of it everything from maybe credit card numbers to potentially specifications for a new project that must absolutely be incredibly protected, or potentially acquisition information or pre-earnings information. That kind of stuff that we have to make sure we're taking incredibly good care of from a security perspective, we call that HBI. MBI is kind of the basic level security within our company. It's what do you consider secret of? Here's the content that it's internal, it's entirely confidential. In fact, it's more than just confidential. It is a secret content. Maybe it's next generation Windows specifications, for example. Maybe it's sales plans or other information that's highly proprietary. We need to protect it, but it's not that top of the top stack from a security perspective. We also have what we call LBI, which is kind of lower business impact content where the content is confidential. It's still risk. We want to protect it, of course, but it's not public. And public, of course, being that kind of lowest level rating. And so when we ask our employees to classify their applications or SharePoint environments, we ask them to classify using certainly those top three schemes. Internally at Microsoft, we don't ask people to classify a SharePoint site as public because it's not an internal SharePoint site if it's public, right? That would be a more public resource available.
And then the one thing I wanted to say here is that as you look through these definitions, you can definitely see, there can be shades of variation between them. And also, two pieces of content together may actually change the data classification. So within the context of how we do our governance and within the context of our solution, we offer a lot of guidance for our employees so they, to help them understand which classification they really should be using. And we'll, I'll be walking through some examples of that a little later.
Absolutely. So let's talk about some of our principles and policies for a minute. I mean, first of all, you know, security and governance has to be effectively up-leveled with experience. Ultimately, if I have to empower my employees to get their job done. If I don't, if my governance is heavy-handed and overly bearing, then my employees are simply going to find some other way to share their information. I have to make sure that they're on my services. Because the beauty of them being on my services is now IT has visibility into it. I can manage it. I can govern it. I can deal with that, the fact that content's there. So I really need that content being on my service. And of course, yes, as a company, we can police and we can tell our employees not to use other things. But we know if our governance is overly aggressive and overly blocking effectively, employees are going to find some simple other opt-out. So our rule number one is empower our employees to get their job done while at the same time protecting our assets and making sure that we are holding our employees accountable. That at the end of the day, I'm going to trust you, Mr. Windows employee, to know who you're sharing with, for example. But at the end of the day, if that employee overshares and potentially breaches confidentiality from the company, they'll be held accountable to their actions. And we will know that, and we apply things accordingly to deal with this. So these are kind of some of our basic guiding principles. You can see we have others here. I mean, obviously, we want to do things like manage SharePoint growth and make sure we've got understandable, manageable SharePoint environment. We want to make sure we can understand our site collection management and, you know, know we have good owners and so on. But these are generally the whys we're doing these things. So we can again, generally back to those first three principles of holding our employees accountable, know who we're holding accountable, know we've got real value of the content we have, and it's not just sitting there forever. So when you think about this, our policies that we actually go deal with that are things like we want to make sure we're enforcing least privileged access. Things like we want to make sure that employee isn't oversharing broadly. That if we're bringing in an external guest in. And by the way, that is something that we'll talk about a little bit later that you can turn on or off if you so choose. In our case, we do enable and allow guest sharing in certain scenarios. And we want to make sure that there's a process where the guest is being invited in. Carrie will talk about that in a little bit further. We also want to make sure that limited access is with respect to security. If I have a HBI site, that top secret site. You know, if you have a top secret site, it's probably not meant for everyone in the organization. It's probably not meant for all guests, and certainly not anonymous. So we look for things like, hey, you've got an HBI site. Well, that site has been secured to everyone except guests, for example. Everyone, and that's probably not appropriate. And so we're going to ask that question of, hey, this site is probably overshared, especially given its classification. We'll flag that site for compliance, for example. And Carrie will talk about that a little more later. We're also, though, in order to make that work, we want to make sure we've got data classification, that those sites are classified. I know that this content has been classified as top secret, HBI in our language, effectively. And I'm going to enforce that classification, and then I'm going to run those policies against it. I'm also doing things like making sure that I've got site lifecycle management, that in order to make sure that I've got a governed SharePoint environment that's got limited is actually active, we're going to ask those questions and make sure that not only do we know that we've got an active owner for that site, but I also have activity on that site. The site has value still, and we want to make sure we enforce that. First of all, before we talk about kind of what we do in addition to the basic product, let me just call out. The basic product has 90% of what we're looking for in terms of the basic capabilities, in terms of managing our SharePoint environment. Everything from the DLP capabilities to making sure that I can scan our environment. When we do security governance, I can look for credit card numbers, for example. I can look for content that might be under some pattern that I want to look for and deal with, quarantine, isolate, lock, whatever. So I have got core product capabilities for that. I've also had things like encryption at rest so that I know the product is storing and protecting my information. I know that I've got the ability to encrypt the content for delivery so that I can IRM libraries, for example, and rights protect the content. And so that if I choose to have top secret content on a SharePoint site, I can then make sure that if I so choose, that that content is IRM protected. So if someone does download it to their device, I can then go deal with that accordingly. So the basic capabilities here, and I'm not going to go through a whole list, these are all core out-of-the-box capabilities the product and 365 suite provides. There's a lot more information at aka.ms/wactoon, and the whole URL is here, that you can find more information about how 365 and how what trust and certification it provides, and how effectively they're enabling compliance capabilities within the core product itself. So let's talk a little bit about best practices on an HBI site. So if I have a top secret site, forget tooling for a minute. I mean, number one, I'm going to make sure, I want to make sure that you as an owner are kind of thinking about these things, that you're understanding and you're vetting who actually has access to this site. You're not broad reaching it. You're not oversharing it. You're minimizing the permission. And by so doing, you're probably not inheriting permissions from something else. One of the challenges with SharePoint permissions historically was that people would tend to inherit permissions from a parent library or site. The risk there being that inheritance might be from a lower security site. And one of the things we try to do is basically say, you probably shouldn't have a high business or top secret site sitting underneath a lower business impact site or a non-secured site, because you want to make sure that, again, you're securing yourself properly. So we tend to encourage HBI content, for example, to be in isolated sites, not under something else. And if it is under something else, to make sure we're not leveraging inheritance and breaking away inheritance. We also want to make sure that you're reviewing your membership on a regular basis, that you are every 6 months, especially if you have external guests or if you have an HBI site, you're understanding who has access to that site and should those people still have access to that site. And Carrie will talk about how we go do that a little bit later. But these are generally the things that we want to do. Oh, another big one I should have called out is large security groups. You know, I mentioned earlier the everyone, but it's not only that. We generally encourage people to say, let's add security groups you have some control over, and they're not broad access security groups. Are you adding a divisional security group to your top secret site? That's probably suspect. Maybe there's a good reason for it, but on the other hand, you really should be vetting that security group. Well, generally, the kind of rule of thumb that we use is if you're adding more than 500 users to a top secret site, there's probably a need to vet and say, am I using the right security groups? Am I using the right security on that site? And this is simply the guidelines that we provide our employees more broadly to encourage them to hopefully do the right thing. Now, Carrie's going to talk about how we actually go make all this work.
So I get the fun part of walking you through a demo to see how this all works in practice. One of the things about that previous slide is those are guidelines that we provide to our employees through user campaigns, through communications. What I'm going to be talking about now is the actual governance system that enforces all of the policies that David talked about earlier. So just at a higher level, we have a lot of categories under site provisioning and management, and that's kind of where we start our process to be able to govern our sites and content. So in that box about site creation and classification, we have a central hosting options page where people can select the type of property that they want to create. The form that we use is a custom provisioning form that allows us to collect a lot of extra and additional metadata and use that to govern our sites a little bit more. Also from there, one of the pieces of data that we can collect and assign is the data classification. And as we go into that more, you'll be able to see that in practice. It's some pretty great stuff. Under site management, David has also expressed that we really do hold our end users accountable. But in order to do that, and in order to go to that other core goal of enabling our users to be productive, we provide a lot of tools for them and a lot of awareness so that it's easy for them to do the right thing. And it's a really great process for them as well. So another thing that we can do is using that additional metadata we collect to do additional enhanced reporting for us to keep an eye on what's really going on across our giant, giant ecosystem. I don't know if David really emphasized some of those numbers on that first slide, but we have, I think, about 80,000 team sites at this point.
On 365.
And somewhere around 170,000 plus of the personal OneDrive for Business sites. So it is a large, large amount of content, and it's not something that we could govern without these automated processes. Under protecting sensitive content, we do have some specific policies that we enforce on those sites, and we also do more monitoring and reporting. And I could talk in generals, or I could go into it right now, which is the fun part of this. This slide is really about the life cycle of an issue in our system. This is generally how the whole system works. You can kind of start at that top right, the monitor, where we're running these policy jobs once a week to look for any policy violations or compliance issues. The word violation is so harsh. Basically, we're looking for a lot of those policies that David had discussed before. Is the site about to expire? Do we have two owners on it? Do we have a site that somehow slipped through and didn't get classified? So anything like that is going to produce a hit in the system. The site owner gets notified through email, as well as a banner that shows up on the site, and I'll show you that in a sec. And then they have about 2 weeks to do something about it. If nothing happens after 2 weeks, we kind of up the game a little bit, and that notification on the site is displayed to anyone who visits the site. And this really covers that scenario where a site owner has moved on, they may have left the company, the site may still be very active and in use, and other people may not realize that they no longer have an owner. So by telling everybody on that site that, hey, there's some kind of an issue and this needs to be dealt with, or we're going to turn it off, it's kind of amazing how much more interaction you then get from the users of the site. So after a month and all these notifications and emails, if nothing happens, we lock the site. That is usually the point at which somebody will stand up and do something because, you know, really the best way to identify who cares about something is to turn it off. Mm-hmm. There is a little button on there where people can unlock it for a temporary amount of time. So if they need to get their work done, again, enabling our users and not blocking them, they can unlock it for a week while they deal with the issue and get the work done and maybe go through a process to promote a new owner. We do have a process through our help desk where you can go in and get yourself promoted or get another user promoted in the case where that site has kind of been abandoned by its owners. If we get past that a little bit more, the site is eventually recycled and then deleted. And I think, what's our percentage of sites that kind of end up being deleted every year? I think it may be.
So it's we're roughly staying at par. So we've been kind of growing very slowly, yeah. A couple of thousand sites a year, even though realistically we actually have a lot of churn. So we do delete a lot of sites.
Yeah, and that's great because that means that the content that's left in our environment is relevant, it's managed, and it's there. And you know, we don't have a bunch of junk coming up our search index.
And one question, by the way, as you get, they came up from the audience here, was around the how do we mm-hmm. train our mm-hmm. HPI site owners, and how do we make sure people are doing things like vetting the security groups?
Great question. The first part of that, we do have yearly training for all of our employees where we talk about protecting your HPI sites, where I believe we talk about some of these best practices for site owners. We have this in internal sites that people can visit. The next part of the question, if you hang on, I think it may be answered because it's one of the policy checks that we do. Actually, I'll just answer it. In this life cycle that I'm talking about, one of the things we check for is the site HPI, and does it have a broad access group? And if so, that'll trigger the policy compliance thing. It will trigger an issue, and that site owner will be told to go and remove that broad access group, or maybe reevaluate if it really is an HPI site. Because if you're adding, you know, everyone or everyone plus external users, then my guess is that it's really not top secret.
But ultimately, you as the business owner have to make that decision. IT can't.
Exactly.
We don't necessarily know the true value of a content. The best we can do is encourage you to think through and make the right decisions that those two things don't make work together, HPI plus everyone.
And so now the fun part, I get to show you what the system actually looks like. This first page I'm showing you is what we call our hosting options page. And this is where people can come and see what the different types of sites and properties are they can create. I'm going to move ahead because I do have a lot of content. I realize that we want to give you time for questions. This next screenshot is showing you what our site provisioning form looks like. For anyone very familiar with SharePoint Online and the out-of-the-box form, you'll see it looks like the form, the regular form, but a lot longer with a lot more data in it. We're collecting the regular name. One of the things that we do here is we allow people to designate a URL because after many, many years of self-service provisioning, what we found is that not giving people this option produced a lot of help desk volume of people who weren't very happy with the URL that got assigned. So just that one field actually drove our help desk volume down a lot. It was a good move. One of the fields on here is adding an extra owner. One of the policies we check for is every site has to have two owners because having two people designated as a site collection admin, you know, increases your chances quite a lot that somebody's actually looking after the content and responding to these notifications. If one of these people leaves and they're no longer resolvable in the GAL, then that does trigger one of those policy cycles and we require that people add another user. One of the users has to be a full-time employee, but another user can be a contingent staff. You'll notice I'm going to skip the data classification because I'll do a little bit more in the next slide. But one of the checkboxes on here is for external sharing. David touched a little bit on external sharing. What this means is that this site is able to be shared outside of your organization. This means that I can invite somebody from Boeing or from one of our manufacturing facilities to come and collaborate on this site with me. You may not want that on, for example, in a sensitive site. You may not want your site members to be able to be inviting people to the site. By default, it's off. So if you do want that, you can turn it on from this form. And one thing to know is that the only other way to enable or disable external sharing on a site is through the tenant admin tools. So this is a nice way to empower our users to decide how what the scope of sharing they want to be on the site. There's also an attestation on here with a link to our sharing guidelines as well as other employee responsibilities for being a site owner. So that's a nice thing to put up in front of people and just say, hey, here's just some things you need to know about owning a site here at Microsoft.
And there was a question about the metadata that we request, which I think you just covered. I would add to the statement that Carrie went over the basic form and what's available. We also enable divisions to customize the form even further to say maybe legal wants to collect some additional other information when they create a site because they want to have things like, well, is this casework, for example, or is this related to patent work or whatever. They might want to classify their sites as an example. And so we allow the divisions to collect additional metadata as well. But the basic metadata that we collect is the data that for every site collection, because we do try to minimize for the vast majority of the company, is what Carrie just went through.
Right. And if that was an architectural question, the AutoSites governance service that I'm talking about and our little architecture diagram comes at the end is actually an Azure app that's running in the cloud, and there is an Azure SQL database where we're storing all this data. This next form shows how the experience works with the data classification. You'll see that there's a drop down there where people can select LBI, MBI, or HBI. The neat thing is that each time you select one of these data classifications, some extra detail comes up at the bottom that gives the employees a little bit more information about what it is they're doing, as well as a link out to the full information security and risk management site that really goes into a lot of detail. We also have a little handy-dandy chart here under Show Me More that gives you a very brief overview of what type of data would generally fall under each of those classifications. We do have a data classification wizard because, as I mentioned earlier, sometimes combinations of data can result in a higher data classification. So there's this very interactive, my data is this, this, that, and that, that will give you a better idea of the overall data classification. We're trying not to get too complicated, but for a lot of cases, people do want that type of information, and we make it really easy for them to find it right in the context of this form. Okay, limit on a broad access group. I see another question. The way we do this right now is we basically have a blacklist of broad access groups that are very, very, very large. We would love to extend that, and I would almost say that the limits of those groups are maybe in the 10,000s. We would really like to get lower, and we're constantly looking for ways to improve this. David was saying that as a general rule of thumb, about 500. I would almost go down to about 50. I mean, when we're talking HBI, we're talking some very, very highly sensitive data. But I also think that when you're looking at the governance system for your own corporation, this is something you really have to think about. You know, for you, what would fall into your data classifications? How would you define your data classifications? We do it one way, but I think everybody's going to do it differently.
Yeah,
I
think the fact is that the blacklist that Carrie talks about, we just create that as part of our governance scanning job. Mm-hmm. It looks for that list and says, are any of these security groups there? We can add to that list at any time if someone requests and says, hey, this group really shouldn't be on any site either. I think in a perfect situation, we would be able to scan for security groups real time that say have more than 500 people in them. We don't do that today. We simply do a blacklist approach today. That's simply where we are.
Yeah, that it would be a very expensive operation at this point with the amount of security groups that we manage. And I'm sure that's a whole other topic is security groups and management there. What this is showing is once that data classification is fixed and the site is created, we have different ways to show what that data classification is. So anybody using that site kind of knows what is expected of them when they're handling that data, when they're sharing that data, when they're uploading that data. It's a big part of the user awareness. for HBI, we have a big, bold, pink banner that's just like, hey, this is really very important data. It does link out again to the ISRM site to give more information about the handling of HBI and other important information about that. That kind of goes back to the user awareness question that right here in the context of the site, we give them information about what HBI means. I'll show you an example of what MBI looks like in a little bit. It's much less bold, but it's still there and it still does link out to more information. This is our policy alert. We recently changed this because we felt it was too subtle. And now if you have a policy issue on your site, you come to the site, you're going to be greeted with this big red yield sign, action required. It actually does load this message about you have a, basically there's something wrong and you need to do something about it. Although we say it very politely, it's pretty much in your face and it's hard to miss this. Also remember that an email is going out to all the site owners as well. And when I say site owner, we consider the site collection admin to be the owner.
Although one thing we've realized that Microsoft sending out email is not necessarily going to hit the person you intend. You know it's going to reach them, but they may or may not ever see it or read it. The volume is simply reasonably high, and so we realize that this on-page messaging is absolutely critical.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And one other thing I'll point out here is you see that nice yellow MBI, and it is a little less in your face than the HBI, but it's still very evident that it's there. Okay, once you click on that, the link that's in the notification there, we bring up the compliance form. And this form tells you what all the issues are with that site and also provides a very clear path as to what needs to be done to fix it. This is a nice way to make it easy for a site owner to figure out what's wrong and to do something. You can see here this site owner has lots and lots of site collection admins, so it's a good thing there. In this case, it looks like they've gone ahead and added some site owners after mm-hmm. they were notified. So this form is sort of on its way to compliance. Yeah. You can also see that this site has expiration date coming up pretty soon. So the site owner can make a decision here saying, hey, I am using the site. I want to keep going. Or if they just ignore it, the site will eventually be recycled and deleted. So what if you're someone like me or David who probably owns about, 20, 50 sites at Microsoft? And a lot of those are legitimate, and many of them are testers. It's hard to know what that whole body of your accountability is, and we've created what we call the Sites I Own page. This page lists all the sites for which you're being held accountable, but it also gives you a nice, clear indication of any sites that have issues all on one page. You can see that I am not being a very good site owner here. Every single one of mine has a little issue there, fix issues. If there was no issue with the site, there would be nothing. I think what shows up now is you can click a button to go ahead and decommission that and put that into the recycle and delete process. But this shows us all the active sites, all the sites that are under decommission, meaning there were some issues that nobody dealt with and they're going through that process of being decommissioned and eventually deleted. And then inactive is sites that I used to own that have now been deleted. Okay, and we also, through all the metadata we're collecting about these sites, we have additional reporting that allows us to get a high-level view in some cases of, for example, all the different sites under certain data classifications, sites with compliance issues, sites that have external users. And we also have some very, very detailed reports that allow us to drill into every single site and all the metadata associated. Okay, lots of questions coming in.
So the first one was about basically the collection of metadata and where we enforce that. And yes, people sometimes go in the Word, for example, or Office or whatever, they upload the document directly. Now, we could enforce and say, we could have a content type and say, we must collect this metadata at document save time. We choose not to do that at the document level for team sites, because again, we want to make sure that we're empowering our users and are out of their way. So we require the classification of a container. So we classify the site collection or site itself, not the document individually, which might be, is that a perfect solution? Would it be better, of course, if we collected metadata on all documents? Yes. But that said, for the very reason that the question kind of asks, we believe that our employees are less, they're going to find other paths to manage their content if we require metadata simply on team site. Now, there are other spaces within Microsoft where we require metadata of a document level. If you're publishing into a knowledge management system or a portal, or if our content must be discoverable, then yes, I have to I have to therefore apply metadata to the content, and there's no choice. But in cases simply doing classification for security purposes, we classify at the container level, not the content level, simply to deal with this notion mm-hmm. that employees don't want to have to overtag.
Okay. I think we answered that second question about the dashboards where we are reporting on all this metadata. That one, again, we've got a couple of these roll-up reports, an example of which I'm showing here, but we also do have reports that list a row for every single site and all of the data we've collected for it. David, I'm going to let you kind of review those next questions and maybe we can take a break because we do have a bit more fun content to go through. User awareness, we talked a bit about some of those campaigns that we can run. So I talked about the in-context user awareness, notifications, banners, things like that. But we also do have sites and where we have a ton of content for people to come and visit and learn about the sites, as well as running campaigns where we send out emails, we communicate through Yammer, we have digital signage in all the hallways at Microsoft where we can give them just a little bit of information and send them to one of these sites. So there's quite a lot that goes on. So shifting a little bit to a specific area of governance, we both mentioned external sharing at Microsoft. External sharing, again, is the ability to send a sharing invite outside of your organization and invite people who work at other companies to come in and collaborate with you in the SharePoint Online environment. It's a really powerful feature. It's the wave of the future. We're hearing that in a couple of years, probably more than 50% of the collaboration within organizations will be happening outside of the organizations, actually. But this does introduce a lot of risk into our environment. And so we have done a lot to ensure that we can provide as much guardrails and governance around this as possible. One of the things I glossed over a little bit in my bio is a lot of the work that I do is actually working with the product group to produce our feedback of how we feel about the products they create are at the enterprise level. And so through a lot of feedback, we've seen some really great strides in the ability to govern these products right out of the box. And this first slide shows just in the external sharing space all the things that the product is now offering to help you manage that body of people that don't, you know, that aren't within your organization. So one thing that is out of the box, any site that has had external sharing enabled, and this is at the site collection level, does show a banner. And there's an example of that on the slide where it's saying, this site can be shared with people outside of your organization. We're doing a lot of work and thinking about how to improve that because basically this is just saying the site has the potential to be shared. So we need to make it more clear when it has been shared. Also, when you are sharing something outside of your organization, you do get a nice alert within the context of that sharing and the sharing dialogue saying, hey, just so you know, this person you're sharing with isn't in your company. You can control the external sharing tenant-wide. You can actually turn it off for your entire tenancy if you just don't feel that it's appropriate for your organization, or it can be turned on, but at that site level. And again, each site out of the box, default, it's turned off. We allow our employees to turn it on through our custom provisioning, but you may or may not want to do that in your org, and you may want to just have a workflow where it does go through your help desk, and you vet each of those requests about whether or not that content should be shared. The scope of what an external user can access is very limited within the organization. As an internal user, you can do a lot of search and discovery and find great stuff. As an external user, you only have access to that site and the content on the site that you've been invited to. That includes membership as well. You can't go trolling through the gal looking for people to spam or try and see if you can figure out some strategic partnerships going on just by populations that you see. There's been three new very exciting external sharing controls that were just added this month. One is that you can whitelist and blacklist domains that your employees can or cannot share with. There's more auditing of the external sharing invitations, which is very important in the financial and regulatory industry. As well as I got a little bit lost in there. So do you remember what that third one was while I go through the last one here?
No, I think
you, I think I hit them all, actually. I got confused because I covered this also.
The blacklist is the biggest one for us, and that's one of the ones we were looking forward to.
You can also limit external sharing for individuals in your organization.
Oh, yes.
And this is pretty important, again, and for some of those regulatory situations where you may have a whole side of your house that should not be sharing outside the org. So you have control over that.
Yeah. Like, so, for example, on the OneDrive for Business sites, you can say, I'm going to enable an external sharing for everybody, but this division, I'm going to go into our OneDrive for Business sites and turn it off. Uh-huh.
There also are some reports in the tenant admin where you can see the sites that have been shared externally as well as what external users have been invited per site. So within our custom governance solution, we've actually added a little bit more of the compliance issue, compliance controls. The first being, as I showed, that the site owner can decide if they want external sharing on the site at provisioning time. We do also do some policy management. We want to make sure that our external users who are invited to our environment are reviewed and removed when they no longer need access. And so our auto sites goes through and once a quarter reminds the site owner to go through and review that list of external users, actually pulls up that list, and I'll show you what that looks like. So here you can see a list of what the external users currently have access to the site. This is both at the site level and even down at the document level. So this is a pretty powerful feature.
And we had a couple questions about what, you know, the core product and what we've done to enhance it. And I think a couple things. A lot of what Carrie was talking about is core out-of-the-box product capability. If you buy a 365 subscription, you get the core out-of-the-box capabilities, a lot of the core foundationals to manage external sharing, to be able to turn it on or off, to manage blacklisting. All that's in the product. The augmentation is we did augmentation on some of this reporting that Carrie talked about, plus the UI where we enable our employees to turn it on themselves as opposed to having to go back to site collection admin to turn it on at site creation time. So there's things that we do at the provisioning in our what we call our governance layer, our auto sites, but we also have a core product. And I should also just kind of, I think, reiterate maybe just for those who wasn't made clear that we are, as Microsoft IT, we're accountable to the business of running Microsoft. We're not accountable to the business of building 365 itself. Carrie talked about the fact we help influence, just like all of our customers do, influence 365 as a service. But ultimately, the product engineering teams are ones who build it. We're trying to make sure we can run the business of Microsoft, and that's what we're trying to share here. And we'll go into more detail on how you can use some of the things we've done. But the core capabilities are core product capabilities.
Yeah. And again, we also do some custom reporting that provides a lot of information about each one of those external users, as well as what the population is across our entire tenancy. And so one of the big questions that David and I usually get at this point is, wow, this looks great. How can we do this? How can we get a hold of this amazing solution you've built at IT? Microsoft IT, and David will now tell you what's available.
So I think one of the things that we've done, we've worked in conjunction with the Patterns and Practices team, basically dev.office.com, Patterns and Practices, the links will be in the next slide, to make available some additional patterns of things like how do you provision a site? And there's a provisioning pattern up there. How would you override the out-of-the-box provisioning experience and build my own? How would I run jobs and do things like what you do, Microsoft, which is things like, you know, look for that HBI policy or look for oversharing, require classification of the site. Those core jobs and capabilities are things that we've packaged up in conjunction with Patterns and Practices team and have made available. So it's everything that, you know, that we're talking about here. First, there's the core provisioning solution, which is available, and then the governance, everything from doing the policy management, the lifecycle management, the two-owner policy rules, the classification, the external users policy, basically the cores of what we're doing. We tried to package that up and worked in partnership with Microsoft Services as well as Patterns and Practices to make it available broadly. And so that's now there. And the next slide is actually where we show we've got on dev.office.com and link, it redirects to GitHub. In fact, there's a whole entry point at for Patterns and Practices of aka.ms, WAC Office, DevPNP, where you can find kind of the entry point to the whole Patterns and Practices library. And there's a lot of good collateral there. If you want to poke through and see jobs you can run in Azure to manage 365 or how to augment the UI. I mean, there was a question earlier that I was going to get to now about augmenting the UI. Like the question was, do you change the master page when you want to put site stamping on it? And the answer is no, we do not. We do change the master page in certain scenarios, but not in this one. Our core, for most of site collections at Microsoft, we do not touch the master page at all. All we're doing is overriding and adding controls on the page after a fact to basically do things like show the alerting and the messaging and so on. So we're very careful about that, and all those examples are, again, in that Patterns Practices. You can see exactly how we do it. You can do it yourselves. Mm-hmm. So the goal being here, everything we're doing or talking to are things that you should be able to do too, either because it's from a core more out-of-a-box capability and feature, or it's because the capability is something we've done the augmentation around, and we're packaging up that augmentation and sharing the code. We don't, as Microsoft IT, support, of course, because we're not a product organization, but we make it available to the community for broader use. Right.
There was a question. If a site owner already has thousands of documents and thousands of folders, and they want to move to SharePoint, what would be the easiest way to convert that folder structure, or should it be converted to SharePoint?
If it's a document structure, I mean, so there are new APIs and toolings and third-party products that actually help enable move. Metalogix, Metavis, AvePoint all have tools to help migration. You can also, if you don't necessarily need preserved version history from system to system, even just copying and pasting can work too, depending on what you're trying to do and the volume of what you're trying to manage. But again, the third-party tools that exist from Metalogix or AvePoint or Metavis are all do a great job of, again, of helping do migration into 365. As far as preserving metadata, if the metadata is in the source system, it will preserve it and manage it into the destination from a lot of these tooling.
And so I think you answered this question about deviating from the out-of-the-box master template. Master page.
The product story is yes, you can deviate from a master page, but given that you're talking about doing it across the tenancy, in our case, thousands of site collections, doing so would be a high degree of management challenge to continue to sustain. So. While we do augment the master page and change it in certain publishing portals scenarios, we do not on the team site scenarios.
Okay. There's a question, can this page be made available in O365?
Interesting question. So a lot of the core capabilities that Carrie was talking about, as Carrie said, we're partnering with the product team to try to deal with how some of these are coming. I know the product is looking at a lot of what we have here in terms of gaps in product. I can't commit to saying this capability will be in product, but we'll certainly take that feedback.
Right, and one of the things I want to point out is a lot of what we've designed here is based on what you can access through APIs and what you can actually write on top of SharePoint.
Yeah.
When we communicate a lot of these needs to the product group, we try and communicate them as scenarios and needs because they may have a much better way of providing a solution within product to solve the business need that we have. So as we have these conversations with them, some really interesting ideas come up.
Yeah.
And the thing that we can say about that is they really are listening, and they do see the pains that we go through here at Microsoft.
Yeah. And there really is no secret sauce here. We're using the same public APIs you can use. Sometimes we push on the product group and say, we really need this API really badly.
Yeah.
or we really need this additional screen, and we'll push for that. But we don't do anything that's not public. There's no private APIs we're using or anything else.
Right. So there's a question, how can I buy this? Hopefully we've answered this question, that it's out there and free, and you can go to that Patterns and Practices site and download what you need, hopefully.
Yeah, there are also partners, and I know Microsoft Services has an engagement offering that they offer as well if the customer wants to engage Microsoft to help you implement this. But since the pattern is there, you can take a look and see what you can do on your own, too.
Okay. There's a question, all these tools are out of the box, and I'm assuming that you're referring to the two slides we showed, one about the O365 Trust Center capabilities and one about the external sharing capabilities. The question, is it specific to O365 vNext? And everything that we showed you is available out today in O365.
Yeah, I think even the capabilities Carrie was talking about, for example, the new external sharing capabilities, those were rolled out. And in some cases, capabilities take a couple months to roll to all tenancies, but they're all in process of rolling. Certainly, first release customers said everything Carrie talked about.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have to check as to where all of these things stand, but I don't think anything we mentioned isn't broad rolled out now.
Interesting question. Can you whitelist, blacklist domains per site collection?
I'm not sure about that. I know you can do it at the tenancy level, but I'm not sure about a site collection level.
Yeah, we'll have to find out.
Yeah, don't know that one.
It's an interesting question and a very interesting scenario there. Okay, do you identify dead content and make recommendations to site owners? We would love to be able to do that. That's one of the conversations we're consistently having with the product group, is that the whole concept of site expiration is sort of our way of dealing with that, but we're really leaving that up to the judgment of the site collection owner. We do run into some of these scenarios where that site collection owner may be gone, you maybe have somebody else who's managing it. And so the ability to find content that hasn't been used or visited and try and produce that as part of this cycle is something we think about a lot.
And I'd add to this and say, there are certain more managed types of sites that we have, knowledge management systems, publishing portals, record centers, where policy and document lifecycle is much more ingrained. And so we do have this. We've got site collections where they've got very clear document workflow and retention policies applied and so on. And we do that as well. But that's not necessarily for the masses. If I've got all these team sites, I apply the expiration of a site collection level, not at the content level itself. That's how we manage it.
So here's a good one. What is your site decommission process? The site decommission process is an umbrella term we give to that whole process that I showed a couple slides back, where basically we identify an issue, we provide a notification, we provide a second notification, and then we lock, then we move it to recycle, and then eventually delete it. And then at some point it's still available on backup, and maybe they can get it back, but that's very expensive, and we make them pay for it at that point.
Yeah. There's also a question here about records management. And so the interesting thing, we're actually, I think we're getting more mature in this space, but we're still, I'd say, not at the state we want to be. Our legal department has lots of record centers on 365. They've got record centers on-prem. They partner with business groups that have content that must be retained, whether it's because of its engineering practices or because contracts or whatever. They get that content, move it into the record center, and they work for those teams to make that happen. The logical question is, do we have SIN to, for example, on the tenancy, and do we do things like that? No, we don't, not broadly. We encourage those business teams to work for our legal department to move that content into our record center in a more managed way. Because, again, at the end of the day, because we don't require metadata at every piece of content, if it's unmanaged, a team site, for example, then we really need the business involved with that retention process if it's going to happen. Now, there are certain types of content where we require that. You know, if I'm doing ISO compliance, for example, on maybe manufacturing specifications, then yes, I'm collecting metadata and I've got very clear retention policies and workflow on that content. And we do that. But that's where it's not, again, for the masses. It's more specialized content sets that we'll have. And those teams are provisioned with that management in mind. And they know their legal partners, and legal knows to work with them to make sure that content is acquired and moved into Record Center or preserved in place if need be. I hope this was a valuable conversation. We will be putting together, in addition to this webcast, we will be putting together a white paper around how are we doing some of these things. We're also working on a separate white paper around how are we doing migration, because that was, I know, some of the conversation migration. I think before this, we had a how Microsoft does SharePoint for a session, and there are other sessions that are also on Channel 9 about how Microsoft migrated to the cloud more broadly. And so those are also available for your review. And so we will continue to try to hopefully cover how Microsoft manages our 365 environment. And one thing I want to add to this is that when we think about 365, it's not just about SharePoint anymore. It really is the broader space of Exchange, SharePoint, Skype for Business, Groups, Delve, Enterprise Search. It's a gamut now when we think about the stack. And a lot of capabilities we're talking about here are kind of focused first on the SharePoint side, because that's kind of where we get these things in. But they apply just as equally to other kind of capabilities and workloads.
Yeah. We do have some more questions.
Great.
Based on your rules, do you prevent HBI sites from being subsites? We currently don't, but it is something we have discussed because of the complexity of inheriting permissions and people not really understanding that model. We do recommend that people create them as their own subsites, but we're not actively enforcing that.
Yeah, I think that if we chose to do that, we could say we could simply block it. The tooling is easy. That's not the hard part. The hard part is the change management. The people that are doing it today, how do you help them move their content if they already have a site with a complex site structure and now suddenly they want to add an HBI site to it, or they've already had one and it's been there for years. How do you help them get it out? And so it's that change management that's a challenge, and so we simply haven't pursued that one. But it's one of those policy backlogs of saying, where do we find the most risk? And we continue to reevaluate and say, you know, what are we going to do next to enhance our policy work to turn on new policies if we need to?
One thing that we do enforce is if you select HBI as the site classification, you are not able to check the mark to enable external sharing. We require now that the site owner goes through an exception process with our security people so that they can keep more of an eye on that situation, and they have to attest to a lot more strict site guidelines there.
Absolutely.
What if the site is a project site that requests the content be retained for 7 years? And we basically go on a one-year expiration cycle, and whoever is that project site owner will just need to continue to re-up the expiration.
Now, they can turn on, I mean, we can turn on retention policies, and it's something that we have a process where if someone wants to engage FIT to help them on more specific scenarios like that, we will do that. We will do so.
Yeah.
But as Carrie said, the default, if you don't engage IT, is you know, you'll follow basic policies and program. But also, typically, if you're something like that, you'll probably work for your legal partners, and legal will be, you know, driving records in our conversation.
We have 5 minutes. Do we do anything special for OneDrive sites? Right now, so OneDrive for Business, we put them through this a lot of the same processes as our, for compliance purposes, as our team sites. They get some of the same notifications, but also because of the special nature of them and being personal, they don't have the expiration, they don't have a lot of those type of policies.
Right. So we use the default in-product, basically decommissioning process for OneDrive for Business site. When the employee is outside of the Active Directory, the product will add the former manager, give them access to a site to let them pull off whatever that manager may deem required and needed to preserve that employee's content. But again, for OneDrive for Business, from the lifecycle perspective, we're out of a box. From the external sharing perspective, we kind of do some of these same things Carrie's talking about.
So, interesting question. Would you add retention period question to your site creation screen? That's not something we've necessarily talked about.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are divisional needs for that. And you know, we will continue to have and revisit that conversation with our legal partners around how do we broaden retention management? Because, again, it's when are you collecting and enforcing that metadata, and which then in turn drives retention versus not? And if legal told us we want to collect additional metadata at site creation time that said, let's define retention policy for the site at creation time, we would do that. And the framing that we've already got for how we manage site creation and how we manage lifecycle could all basically be enhanced to work with that. It's simply one of those things that we haven't done.
Okay. How often do we run policy enforcement check on the sites? Is there a performance consideration across a huge number of sites?
That's a great question.
It really is.
So with 80,000 site collections, we run the job weekly. Now, you can say weekly, is it really good enough to catch everything? We find it does a pretty good job. And so, yes, we do run a job weekly, and it takes a few hours to run once a week, and it's why, again, we also do it off hours. Like, we run it weekly on Saturdays, off hours, business hours, because we want to, again, minimize impact. And yes, when you're scanning and iterating across the entire tenancy, there is potential, which is why we work through that.
We've got 2 minutes and many more questions, so we're going to have to do speed round here. Are your HBI sites separate collections or under general business unit collection? As of today, they're under the same collection as all the other team sites.
Yeah, it depends on the business. They
can
either
round.
Separate or not.
Okay, are there any thoughts about allowing external access at the site instead of site collection? That is a product group decision. It's something that's kind of been discussed, but generally it's a property at the whole site collection, and I have it's just not something that is a high priority based on all the other things that we discuss with them.
Yeah.
If you have an HBI site that reviews its members groups, do you ask them to review any embedded Yammer groups as well? Interesting question. And
we have slightly different Yammer processes today, and it's a little more manual on the Yammer side. But the answer is we do not enforce that today.
Okay. Is there a way to convert a user's OneDrive site to a SharePoint site?
Other than moving the content, I mean, again, if you want to, nothing out of a box, you would use third-party tools or mover content via Explorer.
Okay. I believe it's time for us to close the session. Thank you so much for dialing in and being so interactive. Those were some really interesting questions, and in fact, I think got some wheels turning in our heads about some of these ideas.
Think about,
And we're checking out now. Thanks
a lot.
Thank
you very much.
Bye.